Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Donald Trump has signed an executive order launching the country's American AI initiative. That AI, of course, stands for artificial intelligence. The move pushes for more research, training, and international guidelines, but it doesn't include any details about funding. Oh, well. Joining us is Ohio State University professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering in the Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence Research, Jim Davis. Welcome back.
Hello.
So was this like, yay, or way behind the eight ball anyway?
It's a little of both.
Okay.
So for me, on the academic side, of course, we were all excited about this because that's going to promote research in both the academic side, because there's also talk about making more educational programs that teach people. They could come in for certain degrees in AI to push the economy. But there's also another aspect that we're excited about is that they're talking about building more and extensive databases. So when it comes to AI of today, it's all about data. So we need more data to analyze, to learn the trends, to be able to predict the things that we need to be able to deal with. So when this comes up, it's going to enable a whole new front in the field.
So you think that when they talk about this new initiative, one of the goals is going to have to be finding more data?
Absolutely. And look at the main companies that are pushing the AI forefront right now. Look at Google, Amazon, and such. They have all of the data. They have so much coming in from all of their user bases. They can learn and try to adapt their systems to model the trends of people to try to do all the predictions they need. So all the algorithms, there's millions and millions of parameters in AI algorithms these days. So how do you train and learn this? You need lots of data. You can't just say, here's one example, try to figure out what the world's going to be based off of this. Mm-hmm. We want, from 10 years ago, it was hundreds to maybe thousands of examples to train a system up. Now we're trying to deal with millions. So the more data, the better.
Why isn't it just as well left to the private sector to go forward with these bold initiatives?
In part, it will be. But again, where are they going to come from? So we have to seed these companies. So that's where the educational trend is going to be coming in. They want to start these programs that train more in the United States, that the people coming into these companies are coming from the United States but have the background, and we have lots of people to do it. So we have to have that educational backbone.
The White House said, and this is a quote, that the United States is the world leader in AI research and development and deployment. Is that the way you see it? Is the U.S. number one?
I would agree with that personally, though, as we all know, you know, China's right there, too. And a few years ago, they made their statement by 2030, they want to be the world leader in AI. So that's when you originally asked about, how we kind of view this. I still kind of view this initiative. I'm very happy for the initiative, but I also view it as almost a reactionary process. So we're going to have to do this, make sure nobody else is taking over as well. But we have most of the AI leaders, I would still argue, are still in the United States.
Because they're the people who have the data.
Well, the data is going to be coming from the company organizations, but you need talent no matter what. So it doesn't matter what the company, whether it's, again, those big companies we're talking about or just in the automobile manufacturing. Everyone's looking forward to autonomous vehicles. Where are the people coming from to design that technology and make that happen? So, again, it's more about a talent pool. The data is going to come from the companies. So whenever they're studying – so look at Amazon. Everyone buying items online, millions of people are buying every day. So they have all of the trends. They know what – if you buy this, you might have a preference to buy this other piece item for you when you're shopping. So they can learn this from lots and lots of examples. So it really comes from the company base, from the data. And that's why we're excited from the government. If it was going to be more medical analysis – or any of these other fields, if there's an initiative to try to push the data, then now lots of people can start working with us and try to push the forefront, not just a limited few companies that can get the data themselves. Now more people have access to that type of data.
You know, German regulators last week ordered the Facebook to give users a choice about how their data is used and whether their data is used. Is that a thing that you would think could set Germany back, or is it something that would set Facebook back? I mean, when it comes to grabbing that data and using it in the purveyance of artificial intelligence.
That's a limited niche, in my opinion. So that would certainly set Facebook back because the advertisers want that information.
And Germans are good for advertisers to have.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it's more on the company side from that one. I don't see that as a limiting factor from, say, a technology standpoint for Germany itself.
But what if what if the European Union does it? What if the United States, as a lot of people have suggested, starts to devise regulations and limit the extent to which social media particularly can gather data?
Yeah, it's definitely coming. And you actually touch upon, I think, a bigger issue that's coming. Is now that these initiatives are coming, especially for the United States that was just launched here, the notions of is the doom and gloom of AI, is it the end of humanity? It's coming. You're going to hear it. And even before coming in for
the naysayers.
The naysayers. And there is some validity to do that, and we can always discuss that if we would like.
I've watched Terminator.
See, that's exactly where I was going to go. So right before I came into this interview, I was on Facebook sitting out in the lobby. And the first thing that came up on my link was that, you know, Trump announces the new AI initiative. And the picture on the top was Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator.
I'll be back. Yeah.
So it's always those kind of issues that is this going to be a problem? And it's always been around. There's actually entities and organizations that are trying to build, quote, safe AI, and make sure we put limitations in so we don't have this problem in the future. We've all heard in the news from Elon Musk to Stephen Hawking, you know, promoting this, saying we got to be careful. We got to be careful about this.
Because I've also seen iRobot and read the books. it's some people question whether is it something that humans can control, infinitely. Can we stay in front of it?
There's two camps on this. One camp says that this is not a problem. The other camp is, it's the end of the world. And then there's actually a middle ground that says we've got to be very careful about this. I'm personally on the middle ground because in today, artificial intelligence, you also hear the terms machine learning. It is all about machine taking data, understanding from it, and doing actions, and it can adapt itself. That's the learning component. If you leave a gap in the algorithm that's trying to optimize itself, it almost every time we see this when we run these algorithms, it will take advantage of whatever it needs to do to solve the problem it needs to, and it might give you unexpected consequences. So here's a classic example that we'd like to talk about. Let's design an AI that would minimize human suffering. That's what we'd like. Hmm. But as you probably can guess where I'm leading on this one, a simple answer that could come out, it might determine that maybe it should wipe out all of humanity now.
Start over again.
Because it won't suffer anymore.
Yeah.
And we all laugh about that comment, but when we look at these algorithms that we build, and people might have heard of genetic and evolutionary programming, it's all built on, again, optimizing some kind of function that you're going to try to evaluate. How good am I doing? And if you leave gaps out, it'll do whatever it takes to actually optimize the things that it only cares about. So if you make it really small, like that joke, I could see things going in a certain way. And we've seen this in the stock market recently, last year. Not a great scenario in the market, and it's been brought about that the robotic AI traders were also hugely impactful in that last year. So they might do a more aggressive trading if they're seeing certain behavior patterns. And I've read several articles that these companies were admitting, yes, our AI robotic traders were very impactful in this event, in a bad way.
Yeah. Isn't that the ultimate threat of AI, though, that it is ultimately based on human nature?
What do you mean exactly?
Well, I mean, you're grabbing the data is coming from human interactions, from human behavior.
The data
we're flawed.
that's very true. So the data drives everything. And that's another great point that you touch upon here, because you might have heard in the news, too. I think it was Amazon recently that was called out for their face recognition system, that it was actually biased.
Right.
And what that means, and there's actually other companies this has been brought up too.
Humans are biased.
We are biased, but the data set was biased. So, for example, if I want to have something to be able to recognize your face or facial characteristics, imagine the data set that was 80% men, 20% women, or 90% Caucasian. Well, it's going to focus on those aspects and the outliers in that data set, but in humanity, they are not outliers. That it doesn't really understand them that well. It hasn't learned to recognize or adapt to those characteristics. So now when you put it in front of someone who's not really dominating that data set, it could have a bias. And maybe it's your phone. You're trying to unlock your phone with your face, and it doesn't recognize you. It never works. Why? Maybe you were part of that bias issue. So again, the data comes from us. And if it does, we got to make sure that it's balanced and done correctly. And if we leave certain things undone, it could cause problems. And it already has.
Then just, I mean, this executive order so far is unfunded. It's unclear what Congress is going to do with it.
Correct.
But what about government at that level getting involved with something like AI? I mean, could it change how it's controlled and how it evolves with government getting involved? Because government isn't the most progressive technology user anywhere.
Yeah, setting policy is going to be the hard part. And that's why I was leading into that other situation we were talking about before. Is it the doom and gloom? How is it going to be? How are we going to react? I think that's going to be the biggest hot button topic. Now, setting government in charge of programs to, you know, for example, fund academic programs to train more people. This is outstanding. This is the way it should be.
It's kind of a no-brainer on that level.
But when it starts to put policy, this will not happen quickly. And we've seen so here's a classic example that we discuss all the time, the autonomous vehicles. The question comes up is if they're driving by themselves and something bad happens, they happen to hit a pedestrian, who's responsible? Mm-hmm. Things like this. Or the harder example is what if the vehicle is put into a no-win situation? It has to do action A or action B. Both of those actions have a repercussion that, say, for example, someone may get injured or damaged. How does it choose? It's going to do one. It has to do one or the other, but both of them have bad repercussions. How do you actually program a system to make an ethical choice? So, for example, there was an elderly person on the left and a baby carriage on the right, and it has to, and it can't get out of the way. It has to go one way or the other. How does it make that decision? And if that's up to us, how do we program in ethics? And there's actually whole teams that are working on this. There's been polls that humans have gone in this and made these decisions, and we can look at how we would try to do this. And so it's on the forefront now because that's the big problem is how do you make sure decisions are done in an optimal way? Do you want military to have autonomous firing drones on their own? And that's a tough – I work with the military.
They aren't already doing it.
Well, I work with the military a lot, and that's one thing that's almost one of these. I'd like it to get to that point, but at that point the human – would be in the loop to take care of that issue. Because once it's at that point where it's completely autonomous, where it has its own kill switch, then again, there's an ethical question that comes up. Could it ever make a mistake? And if it would, what do we do?
Ruth in Columbus, you're on the air with OSU professor Jim Davis. We're talking about AI. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I find your program very interesting, first-time caller. I wanted to bring up the idea you mentioned government involvement, and I saw a video not too long ago about it showed what looked like a very real reporter speaking to people, but it was an AI image. And obviously China controls the news in their country. Is it possible that we could have something similar like that in our country?
The technology, a lot of times you refer to this as deep fakes. They can reconstruct the image. They can reconstruct the video. Most of this has been done on the notion of, you know, can you do it? It's like the technology. How far can we go and what can we pull off from that one? And it's amazing. I've seen what you're talking about and the technology's there. It is concerning. There's been other issues where celebrities have been reposed into other situations that were not forthcoming to what they would want. And that could cause an issue. The technology is certainly there. I haven't seen it pushed in the news. I don't know if... you can never control where it's going to go, but the capability is there. I don't see it actually hitting the news from any broadcast systems. These are all kind of on the web just from individual designers.
Do you think that if a country such as China does take over as number one in leading the way on artificial intelligence, it changes how the world embraces it or uses it?
So when we talk about artificial intelligence, it's a large umbrella term. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about this race that we're discussing right here.
It's not like landing on the moon.
Well, that's actually a perfect analogy because if you talk about the space race, the goal was to have the foot, you know, on that lunar surface. In AI, there is no lunar surface that you can set on unless you would say, I want to build Commander Data from Star Trek. And whoever gets that first is the king of AI. That is not the case at all. So AI covers everything from, like you were talking, from Facebook, the autonomous vehicles, your smartphone, just your robotic vacuum cleaner, your Roomba running around the floor. All of these things have AI in it. So there is, to me, there's really, it's hard to say that there's a winner in my book.
At least nothing that we can define. There's no line in the road.
Yeah. Artificial intelligence itself, you can think about as, you know, it's the automation of intelligent behavior. But that's such a broad task.
It's infinite.
China might be best, say, in the future. They could be great at robotics and autonomous vehicles. But on the other side, we might be on healthcare and other things like that. So it might not be an all or nothing win.
Okay, Ruth, thanks for that call. And Jim Davis, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Great, thank you.
Jim Davis is an OSU professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering in the Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence Research. We've been talking about AI after President Trump has signed an executive order launching the country's American AI Initiative. Of course, at this point, it's unfunded. We shall see, and we'll follow that as it evolves. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Facebook generates revenue by gathering and then selling data about its users to companies that then target ads to those users. Germany isn't interested. German regulators last week ordered the social media giant to give users a choice about how their data is used. New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer covers privacy issues. She joins us by phone. Welcome back, Natasha.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
So Germany is a country of 83 million pretty well-employed people, nearly half of whom use Facebook. What kind of impact does this have on Facebook?
So I think if you think about Facebook's more than 2 billion users, those 32 million people in Germany who use Facebook seem very, very small. But if other nations take up Germany's decision, which gives users more control over their data, it could have a huge impact on Facebook.
Is there a sense that it could, what Germany has done, influence the rest of the European Union?
The European Union regulators are working together now because they had that new law, the General Data Protection Regulation that was enacted last year. Mm-hmm. And so I spoke to the supervisor of each country's regulators, and he said they would be getting together to discuss this German decision. Mm-hmm. Germany has been in the forefront of regulating big tech companies. They've also cracked down on Amazon, and they're also looking at the online advertising market in general.
Mm-hmm. The German regulators used an antitrust argument. How so?
It's really, really interesting because normally we talk about privacy and your privacy is being violated by what's happening to your data. But what they said is when you sign up for Facebook, you know, you have to click, you agree to the terms of service. And one of the things it says is by agreeing, we get to collect your data. And it means that not only are they going to collect information about what you're doing on Facebook, who you friend, what you post, what you message, but it means that you can go on millions of other sites that have Facebook technology, like the Facebook like button or the Facebook share button, and there's even Facebook analytics technology for different websites. And millions of those sites are also able to collect information about you. And Facebook can collate the information from the millions of other non-Facebook sites with your activity on Facebook. And Facebook can also connect if you have other apps that Facebook owns, like Instagram or WhatsApp. Facebook can merge all that stuff. And so what the German regulator said was, this is partly anti-competitive and partly anti-consumer because you're essentially coercing consumers to give up all their data, to give Facebook unrestricted access to collect and use their data, because users don't have any choice, right? It's like a take it or nothing situation. Either you're going to use Facebook and be part of the online social universe or not. And so the German regulator said that Facebook has to give users a choice, that when people sign up, users can decide if Facebook is going to merge their data from other sites with their Facebook data. And the Germans also said that Facebook could not merge WhatsApp and Instagram data, other properties that Facebook owns, with your Facebook account data. So essentially what it means for advertisers who use Facebook to target ads is Facebook already has substantial information about you, if you're a user, about what you do, but that file will not be enriched with the millions of other things you do on hundreds or thousands of other websites. So it will be less precise targeting in Germany.
And you wrote that the terms of service gave people so that all or nothing choice. What do the German regulators envision Facebook doing instead? Just kind of breaking it down and having lots of different things you need to agree to?
I think that you will sign up for terms of service and it will say, we're going to collect your data if you sign up. And, you know, can we also merge it with your data about your online browsing on other sites? And can we merge it if you, you know, use WhatsApp or whatever? So, yes, you will have more choices. And I think that that is the idea of the German regulators. They viewed Facebook as coercing people to give up their data. And they viewed Facebook as abusing their dominant position in the market to kind of achieve even greater data dominance. And that's sort of a new idea because we, as I said, we normally think about this as a privacy issue, and the German antitrust folks have positioned this as a kind of new antitrust argument.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer about news that German regulators have ordered the social media giant Facebook to give users a choice about how whether their data is taken and how it would be used and from where. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. How has Facebook responded?
Facebook has said a number of things. One is that they are not a dominant entity in Germany, right? They said that, first of all, you know, it's not an antitrust issue because you could be on, you know, LinkedIn, you could be on Snapchat, you know, you don't have to use Facebook. And so they didn't buy that argument. They also said that, you know, it's very beneficial to be able to merge all this data. Partly, you know, one thing is you would get more personalized ads, Facebook contends. Also, it's beneficial to their advertisers to be able to more narrowly micro-target you. So they were saying there's all kinds of benefits to this data collection and merging. And finally, they said that the German antitrust folks, and it's sort of like the Federal Trade Commission of Germany, right? It's called the Federal Cartel Office. They said, this is not your jurisdiction because this is a data issue, right? And so there's separate agencies in Europe who are the data regulators, the, you know, they're called the data protection agencies. And so Facebook said, you know, there's this new law that protects your data, and we're abiding by that law, and it should be up to the people who regulate that law, not about antitrust. And the antitrust folks said, you're violating both German competition law and this privacy law.
The Facebook's going to appeal this, right?
Facebook has a month to appeal.
And when they're appealing it, do they appeal it to the regulators or do they appeal it in a court system? How does that work?
Yes, there's a German court that would hear the case. And Facebook is likely to make the arguments that I just said, that like this antitrust has no jurisdiction, that there are benefits to sharing this data, and that they're not actually a dominant player in Germany.
How much clout does do the regulators have on this score?
So this particular federal German agency has brought a number of cases against American tech giants. And in 2013, they filed a complaint against Amazon because they said that Amazon was unfairly prohibiting sellers on the Amazon platform in Germany from offering lower prices off of Amazon. And so that German authority was saying Amazon is sort of coercing and using its market power to narrow competition off of its site. Mm-hmm. And in the end, Amazon agreed and abandoned that kind of coercive pricing practice. So the German regulator has a pretty good history of pushing for change. And this particular kind of complaint they brought, it's actually not intended to fine or punish the company. It's intended to get them to change their behavior. And so it'll be really interesting to see how this turns out.
How about Germans, how are they responding to this?
You know, I didn't hear from individual Germans, but I have heard from folks across Europe that they're watching this case and they're going to see what other countries do. And one of the issues is on the privacy side, this new law says that consumers must freely give their permission to the data collection. And so the folks on the data protection side in different parts of Europe agree that this was coercive and that basically Facebook is freely collecting your data, not freely, you know, getting consent from you to check it.
And then Facebook alleges it's been unfairly singled out for business practices that are common in the industry. And you said, well, they're saying, you're saying Facebook says, well, there's no, what people can just use LinkedIn or whatever. I mean, really, seriously? I mean, someone's suggesting that LinkedIn is comparable to Facebook? Is that a plausible argument?
So there's two things. One is, you know, Twitter and other things exist. And so Facebook is saying there you have choices, but the German regulator is saying those choices are very, very tiny and you're the dominant player in Germany. The second thing is Facebook is saying everybody does this, right? Everybody has these little cookies on websites that track where you go and what you do, and Google also follows you around the web, and so does everybody else. So why are you busting us for this? But the German regulator said, you know, it's possible that if we find other dominant players doing this, coercing people into giving up their data, then we will file a similar complaint against them. So rather than Facebook saying they're just singling us out, the German agency is saying we're going to look at this with major players as well as Facebook. And so it's also interesting because, as you know, Congress in the United States is thinking about introducing a consumer privacy legislation, and they're going to start talking about it. There's a hearing at the end of February, and will also be interesting what the repercussions are in Europe. You know, if European consumers have more choice than Americans, Americans kind of don't like to be left behind, right? Like, we don't like it when other people have better protections than us. So that is going to be really interesting, a tension between the tech companies in the United States, which are enjoying a status quo where we don't have much regulation over consumer data, and consumers who are seeing that, you know, Europeans have a law that gives European consumers much more control and many more rights to their data.
You know, speaking of that, Natasha, is there any sense about when the effectiveness of that law is going to be measured? Is there any plans to look at it and reassess it and how it's working?
So it hasn't been a year yet, and I think there's two things, the short term and the long term. In the short term, all kinds of consumer groups and advocacy groups and individuals across Europe have filed lawsuits against the big tech companies over their data practices. And so some of this law is going to be decided in the courts who are going to set precedents about, like, which part of the law and how it's going to be interpreted and enforced. And so in the short term, we will see more specifics about what the impact is. In the long term, it's going to take, I don't know, 3-5 years or more to see. You know, one of the concerns is big tech companies have hundreds of lawyers who can figure out how to comply with this law. But is this big European law too bureaucratic and too expensive for small companies? And is it actually going to reduce competition? And that's a really important question that we have to see. And the other thing is, because this law gives consumers more choices, it means that you're clicking on a lot more things. And I think we'll also be looking at, are people just clicking agree instead of once, but like 40 times just to like hurry up and get to the thing they want to use? In which case, this law didn't actually make it much better off for us.
Right. I mean, I guess that's the question is, what does it look like? But that won't be emerging until after the appeal process is over with, right?
Yeah. I mean, this lawsuit we're talking about with Facebook is one of dozens of different things. This happens to be brought by the German federal agency, but consumer groups are also suing Google and Facebook and Twitter and various other companies about their data practices in Europe. And so as the courts in Europe decide those cases, the way that this law is going to be interpreted and regulated and enforced will become more specific, and we'll get a better sense of, you know, what's happening.
In the equation of all of this, how important is the need for the tech companies to, you know, monetize what they do? So make money.
So I think that there are several parts to this. One is that companies need the data to improve their products, right? Like if we think about Google Translate, It's through a lot of data collection and seeing what people are looking for and trying different things and iterations that this thing gets better, or even Google search, right? So even for the benefit of consumers, they need to collect some of this data. Secondly, for advertising, I think that it's unclear. The industry would like to continue with this kind of wholesale, unfettered data collection to target you. But we're seeing that, you know, as we saw with the Russians that targeted ads on Facebook to people who liked Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, some of this micro-targeting can have potentially serious effects on democracy and on people's political choices or their choice of educational institution or job or financial services. And so, again, when Congress starts to look at this, one of the questions is going to be, like, should some data not be collected without permission? Should companies be able to collect your religious information or your political information without your permission? Because in Europe, they have to ask specific consent to do that. And then another question is going to be, should some uses of this data not be allowed in the United States?
And then in Europe, as far as deciding what these platforms can get from you, they ask me, can we take this? Can we take that? I say yes or no. Has anything emerging in this? It's not been quite a year, but anything emerging about what people are more willing to share than not?
I don't think we have any trend data yet. But also, you know, if you go on some shopping site in Europe, they're not going to say, can we collect your medical data, right? Because you're not doing anything medical. Mm-hmm. So it's not like every single site is saying, and by the way, can we collect your political information? And can we collect your children's information? And can we collect your medical information? Mm-hmm. And can we collect your educational information, right? There's, you know, it's sites that want the data for specific purposes are going to ask you those specific questions.
Natasha Singer, thanks as always for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha Singer, New York Times technology reporter. She covers privacy issues. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley from Android Central. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Google Maps is rolling out a new feature, not for the driver, but for the walker. AR, also known as augmented reality, offers walkers turn-by-turn directions. This new feature can also help Google Maps users detect their surroundings and get more accurate directions. Joining us to talk about this is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley. Welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
So I thought there on Google Maps, there's been walking directions for a long time, hasn't there?
Walking directions has been a part of Google Maps for a long time, but if you're in a big city, it can get kind of confusing to see where you're going. The closest thing that you really get to figuring out which direction you're currently heading is this little blue dot with kind of almost like a radar thing that sticks out. And some people can navigate that a little better than others. I am unfortunately one of the people who cannot navigate it and regularly find myself walking down the wrong street for a block or two before realizing it, turning around and walking back the other way. Mm-hmm. And sometimes GPS just doesn't work super well in big cities. You know, tall buildings in New York City, for example, can often cause your GPS to kind of spin a little bit while it tries to get an accurate lock. And so finding the direction that you're facing can often be complicated. But by using augmented reality, it can combine what we know the street looks like from Google Maps Street View with the camera view on your phone. So it's actually lining up the shapes of the buildings from photos that have been taken to know that you're actually facing the correct direction.
What does it look like? Is it just kind of the mapping outlines, or is it actual visuals?
Well, so there's a combination of things. The first thing that you'll see in kind of the bottom of the demonstration that we've seen so far is the maps view. There's this kind of bubble around the bottom of the screen. And then above that, you get a camera view using the camera on your phone with some outlines. And what it's essentially doing is trying to line up the lines from photos that have been taken using Google Street View cameras. So if you're in a city and you know rotate yourself around, once it matches a set of buildings with images that have been taken, it uses that to tell which direction you're facing. And from that, it can tell, you know, you need to either turn around or you need to walk two or three more blocks this way and then follow the next set of instructions.
It uses landmarks to orient the user, right?
Yeah, so it'll use anything that has been captured in Google Street View. It'll use the profiles of buildings, or it can use street signs. If there are prominent building signs hanging off the side of buildings, then it can use that. There are a lot of different ways that it can kind of orient itself, but it's all based on photos that have been taken from Street View cameras.
Does it work in every city, or are they just focusing on certain big cities?
Right now, it's only been rolled out to a couple people that are being tested in big cities, but the goal is to have it work everywhere. And a long-term also have it work indoors as well, so that you could actually be in a big mall or, you know, in an airport or something and have the same functionality based on images that have been taken inside of those places.
How long has it been in the works?
This is something we first got a teaser of at Google's developer conference last year. So not quite a full year, but pretty close to 10 months is when we first got a hint that this was something that Google was working on.
And it prompts users, the technology prompts users to put down their phone while walking. That seems counterintuitive. Well, I don't get that.
Well, have you ever seen someone walk across a busy street while looking down at their phone?
Yeah, but how do you use it without looking at your phone?
You can use the audio cues that come from Google Maps, either through headphones, or there's actually also a set of vibration cues that can be used that buzz your phone when a next set of instructions are meant to be used. And you could still glance down at your phone every once in a while. You just don't need to be constantly staring at your phone, especially while crossing busy streets, because that's a recipe for disaster.
But what happens to all of those great videos of people walking into fountains and malls and stuff then?
Oh, you know, there's always going to be something that causes people to look at their phone while they're doing something silly. We can just make sure that Maps isn't one of those things.
Okay. You want to talk about another pair of headphones. Tautronix is what you want to talk
about? Yeah, that's right. These are a set of what are called active noise-canceling headphones. And typically, active noise-canceling headphones can be a little on the expensive side. The job here is it uses an extra microphone built into the headset, and it records all of the sounds that are coming out of the outside of the headset, and it uses some software to kind of flip those sounds around so that you don't hear them inside your headphones. It's a technology that's been around for a while now, and typically it's something that's associated with fairly expensive over-the-ear headphones because the microphones that go into them have to be pretty good, and the software that goes into them has to move fast enough that you don't hear, kind of static or anything. And it's really interesting. The first time you use a set of active noise-canceling headphones, you flick the switch, And it's almost like you've like snapped a set of magic fingers or something. The sound just disappears around you, and it's just kind of replaced by nothing until you start playing music from your phone or your computer or something like that. It's really kind of a cool technology, and Tautronix has embedded this technology in a pair of over-the-ear headphones that only cost $60.
Well, how have they been able to do that?
A lot of it is just that Tautronix has been around for a while now, making inexpensive headphones for quite some time, and they've recently, you know, been focusing on kind of approaching these higher quality features in order to make, you know, people who would normally spend $150 on a set of headphones, you know, kind of look at something a little less expensive and not feel like they're sacrificing anything. And so this has been kind of the next push in that direction.
And so they're noise canceling. You say it's something you usually find in the more pricey options. How do they compare to those pricier options? Is it on target?
It is close. It is not quite as good in my testing. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely something where if I'm on an airplane or if I'm in a busy coffee shop or something, having this feature, even on these $60 headphones, is really great. It really removes a lot of kind of the ambient noise. It makes it so I can focus on the thing that's happening in front of me without turning my headphones up so loud that I'm possibly damaging my own earbuds or eardrums. But they're not quite as good at removing every single sound in the environment. I in testing them on a couple of flights that I took recently, I did still kind of hear some of the noises around me. And in a coffee shop, there was a three-year-old who really wanted a cake pop and was very, very adamant about it. I could hear him continue to demand that cake pop, just not quite as loudly. So it's not perfect, but it is definitely a huge step in that direction. And it's a great feature to have for headphones that's inexpensive.
How do they look and how do they feel?
they really just kind of look like, you know, your standard set of black over-the-ear headphones. They're very comfortable. There's padding that goes around the ears that cover your entire ears. They're not particularly heavy. The battery in them lasted me 3 straight days before I needed to recharge them. And they recharge pretty quickly. These are nice headphones for what you're paying for them. I was really surprised.
Are you an earbud guy or a headphone guy?
It really depends on where I am. If I'm at my desk or if I'm flying or something like that, then I prefer having over-the-ear headphones. But if I'm at the gym or if I'm on my bike or something, then I prefer something that isn't covering my entire ear.
There are concerns about how long the headphones can last. I guess three days, though, is a pretty good time.
3 days is pretty reasonable for headphones that are this size. There are some that'll last you a little longer if you're willing to pay a little more for them. But I feel like, for me anyway, as long as I don't have to charge them every single day, then it's not something that I would usually notice.
Okay. So $60, for people who want to get to a better, sound noise-canceling place, $60 is a very doable amount.
It's great. These are the headphones that I would recommend someone who, you know, you use the headphones that come out of your box, come out of the box with your iPhone, the headphones that come out of there and you're looking for something a little nicer. This is the direction that I would send them.
Okay. You want to talk about the free-to-play Battle Royale video game. It's Apex Legends?
Yeah, so it's kind of a funny name for a game that's built in a universe that already exists, a game called Titanfall that has already been kind of several versions of where you jump in giant robots and you know, cause some damage. This game is in that same universe, but it focuses on the pilots and not on the robots, where you kind of have a squad of people that run around and do things, namely eliminate other people. The goal here for this game is to, very much like Fortnite and some of the other Battle Royale games, where it's a free game that gets you to pay for, you know, the accessories that you would have for your character. So if you want your character to stand out by having a different outfit or by doing a different dance when they've won something, then this is, you would pay extra for that kind of thing. But otherwise, you can download it for free on your Xbox or on your PC now. And in the last week alone, there have been over 25 million people that have jumped on and started playing it.
Wow. In a week.
Yeah, it really kind of exploded in a week. There were a ton of people who started playing it right away.
Is this a departure from what Respawn Entertainment has put out before?
It is a little bit different in that, you know, this is the first time that they've tried this business model where it's a free game and you pay for some of the extra stuff.
Oh, okay.
But this kind of game, the first-person shooter environment is something that this company is pretty familiar with.
And how does it compare to other games available? I mean, there's this first week, 25 million, nothing to sneeze at. But does it have the longevity, do you think?
That's something we're going to, a lot of people are kind of very eagerly keeping an eye out for is how long people are going to continue playing it. But for right now, the company has done a really great job of making sure that there's a ton of options for people to continue playing. There are things that you can unlock if you keep playing so that you can, kind of keep focusing on these short-term goals. And then, being able to run around in squads of three to work together with teammates is something that has been, kind of really exciting for a couple of people. And the game itself is just really, it looks good. So that certainly doesn't hurt as people are going through and playing as frequently as possible.
You compared it to Fortnite. Nothing's bigger right now. Tell us more about how it compares and contrasts.
Yeah, so it's a similar game model in that it's what's called a battle royale game, where kind of everyone starts off and take everyone out until there's no one else standing. That game style has been very popular recently, and it being this kind of free to play system is very similar to the way that Fortnite has been set up.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest difference here is Apex Legends is set up in this kind of very futuristic, almost cyberpunk environment where things have a very kind of hyper realistic and high tech look, whereas Fortnite is focuses more on kind of being more animated looking and a little sillier and is available to play on everything. You can even play Fortnite on your phone. Whereas Apex Legends is right now only available on the Xbox and the PC.
Being able to move from phone to iPad to wherever, to your computer, that's a big thing right now. Are people getting used to that and are going to start demanding it more and more?
I don't know how how much people are getting used to it so much as it enables a different group of person to play.
Okay.
You know, I don't know a ton of people who play on the Xbox and then are happy with playing on their phone when they are out.
Gotcha.
Because the experience kind of drops off a little bit. But people who don't have an Xbox but can maybe borrow mom's phone for a little while, get to kind of enjoy that Fortnite experience. And there's something to be said for some of the problems that Fortnite is causing in schools right now, as kids are bringing phones to school and playing Fortnite in classrooms and causing a lot of disruptions. So that it's, you know, it may not be this kind of long-term excitement that a lot of these companies were hoping for.
I'm wondering why Fortnite, well, I guess because it works on the phone.
Fortnite got popular really because it was one of the first of its kind and it was available everywhere. And there's just a constant push of new stuff. So the people behind Fortnite are just constantly loading new things into the system. And they're always trying new things. They're just constantly giving people a reason to keep doing things. Last week, there was even a musical concert. There wasn't actually gameplay involved,
right,
but a musical concert that was held inside the game where you just kind of sat in what was essentially the game lobby to watch it happen. So it's the result of constant experimentation.
It was only 10 minutes long too, and it just blew some people's minds.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that 10 minute experience kept a lot of people in the game for many hours afterwards.
Interesting. Okay. Moving on. Veterans can now access their medical records on iPhone. It's a collaboration between Apple and the Veterans Administration or just healthcare in general?
No, this is with the Veterans Administration. You know, this is something, you know, Apple has been trying really hard to make sure that its health records app has been secure and stable and available to medical professionals in every aspect of the industry so that, medical professionals feel comfortable sharing their medical information with their patients electronically. And that has grown, you know, pretty confidently over the last couple of years. And has done a lot to kind of shrink the kind of tangled mess that comes from normally trying to shift all of this paper-based content into a digital format for healthcare records. It just kind of reduces a lot of the pain there, especially when it comes to dealing with multiple medical professionals who are maybe not part of the same network. And so this collaboration will make it so that long term, over the next couple of months, over 100 hospitals and now collaboration with the VA will allow veterans to access those medical records, including vaccinations, lab tests, and medical procedures and structures for diagnosis and things like that, all through the Apple Health app. And not only have it so that they can share it with their existing VA doctor, but if they have another specialist that they go to, and then it's very easy to make sure that all of that information is shared with them in one place.
Well, what about, Android phones. I mean, what about people who have those? Is this going to force people to change the kind of phones they have?
It's not going to force them to change what kind of phones they have long term. This is something that, Google has its own kind of medical database system. It just doesn't currently have a partnership with the VA to make this kind of seamless thing. That doesn't mean that it won't happen at some point in the future. It just means that Apple was the first one to prove to the VA that it had this system in place that was already working really well with other hospitals. And so if you wanted this feature right this second, then yes, you would need an iPhone. But if it was something that you were excited about having, over the course of the next year, you can expect the VA to partner with other systems as they grow this technology.
And how are users responding to it?
There hasn't been a lot of public statements that didn't come directly from Apple on it so far.
Okay.
But the groups that Apple has been working with in order to test this have had very positive responses.
Okay. Well, Russell Holley, thanks for your time today. As always, appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He is the a contributing editor for Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. So thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.